You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org, a nonprofit, member-supported radio station. We're millions strong, with folks tuning in from over 200 countries. We are education. We are entertainment. We are the future of food. May is our membership drive. Become a member and support us while receiving e-newsletters, advanced invites, special discounts, and a membership card. We need your support. Visit our website and click the donate button to become a member today. Thank you for believing in us and enjoy the show.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's sunny and very warm here in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and always sunny and warm here at the Heritage Radio Network studio at the famous Roberta's Restaurant. Thanks for joining me. It's More Than Food. I'm Michelle Nishan. I'm your host. This week, it's the week after Mother's Day, and we're here to celebrate notable women in food. And I have with me three of the finest women in any movement who are considered leaders and visionaries in food, in the kitchen, in academia, and in activism. And these three women will join me as we discuss these kind of successes and challenges in a field that's predominantly led by men, and to learn more about what they're doing to change the way our country eats. Joining me today in the studio is Karen Washington, the one and only founder of the Black Urban Growers and respected community activist and gardener for more than 25 years. On the phone, I have dear friend and fellow chef Maria Hines. Maria is based in Seattle, where she opened Tilth restaurant in 2006, one of the very few certified organic restaurants in the U.S. She also has the Golden Beetle in Agrodolce. Shortly, we'll be joined by Dorothy Cann Hamilton, another dear friend, founder and CEO of the International Culinary Center based in New York City. Dorothy also has a show right here on the Heritage Radio Network. The show is called Chef Story. All three are incredibly passionate, talented, highly celebrated with a whole boatload of awards too numerous to mention. So rather than taking up airtime to talk about that, go to heritageradionetwork.org, view their bios, and also access all the other great Heritage Radio Network programming. So welcome, everybody. Hey, Karen, how are you?
Fine.
How are you, Maria?
Good. Yeah. Long time no see, Michelle.
Yeah, like a day and a half. It's so yeah. Funny. We were just in Louisville, Kentucky together, Karen, and doing this kind of chef's activism thing that I was talking about. James Beard does this boot camp for chefs, and it was pretty powerful. Hey, Maria, did you have a good time?
Absolutely. I had a fantastic time.
We were missing Karen, weren't we? But she's here with us today. Anyway, so here's the deal. You know, just to give you guys a little background of what I'm going to be asking you. You know, the food business, I've been in it for a long time. And if there's one thing that I've always noticed, aside from the fact that whether you're farming or whether you're cooking, it's incredibly hard work. But even harder for women, I think. You know, no matter how you slice it, as far as we believe that we've come with women, you know, equality for women in the workplace, this business seems maybe even a little bit behind on some. So I want to get your thoughts for that. You know, why aren't there more women in food, whether it's in the kitchen, you know, farming, culinary schools, et cetera? Let's open it up. Karen, you go first.
Yeah, well, thanks so much, Michelle, for me being here today. I think a lot has to do, I'm going to talk from my perspective, is really living in a low-income neighborhood, in a neighborhood of color. I think a lot of the emphasis is really on family values and really taking care of the family. I think it took a lot for me to really see what was happening in the food world in terms of farming. Growing up, the emphasis for me was mostly on taking care of my family, you know, being supportive, being a homemaker, and food for me was going out, making sure that my family was fed, and the emphasis really wasn't on growing food per se. Excuse me. But now since I'm growing food, I sort of opened my eyes and looked at the realm of the food movement and see that it's predominantly reflected. When you talk about a farmer, it's usually a white male that's being represented. And for me, I want to sort of dispel that myth that if you look at the history of agriculture, it was really women who have been at the forefront for many, many years ago. I mean, we've been in the trenches, we've been growing food for so many years. And I think what I'm seeing now is an upturn of women now starting to get involved in the food movement.
Yeah, I see. You know, it's interesting because in 2007, the United States Department of Agriculture did a census, and the total number of women operating farms increased almost 20%, far surpassing the overall 7% increase in farmers in general. So we added 7% in farmers, but increased women participation 20%. I can't help but notice, but almost anywhere I go and see some of these farming things happening, they seem to be populated mostly with women. I mean, are you finding that in the field? Is that what it's like in Harlem, in the Bronx, where you're working?
I am finding that 100%. In this urban farming movement that's happening in the city, women are getting behind. Women are going out in the trenches. It's like a whole new passion. I think that we've gone from the kitchen back into the field and really having that connection of where our food comes from, that we want to feed our family healthy food. And so what I'm seeing in the urban agricultural movement is women taking that expertise that they've had in the kitchen, taking that expertise about growing families and nurturing families, and now getting that sort of common element into growing food.
Yeah, that's fabulous. Now, Maria, check this out. So women who are executive chefs in our business hold just 13% of the top restaurant jobs, yet they're paid 76 cents for every dollar that male chefs earn. And that works out to be about 15 grand less annually on a salary, if you're looking at salaries. And that stat actually is the same in the workforce at large, where women earn about 70% of what men do. And again, same, you know, those are U.S. census statistics. You now own three restaurants, but you started as a line cook. Take us through the journey of what it was like to work in this male-dominated world with all this testosterone back behind the ranges and stuff like that. How did you survive it? And did that inform you, you know, just deciding to open your own business?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think I'm a little bit fortunate in being maybe a generation that didn't have to deal with a lot of issues of being women, you know, in the kitchen, coming up through the ranks, because of all the work that has been done before my generation. So I have to thank a lot of women out there that has really helped change the perception of women in leadership roles in the industry. And I also think that I've had the good fortune of being in the West Coast, working in metropolitan areas, and I think, you know, I have a pretty thick set of rose-colored glasses when it comes to any sort of, you know, issues being a woman going up through the ranks and achieving leadership roles.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
So, you know, for me, because of those rose-colored glasses, I think I've always been like, wow, I can't believe we're still talking about this stuff. Like, it's a thing of the past, but I'm sure there's a lot of, you know, parts of the country where it isn't a thing of the past. And I did run into it when I was cooking in France in an all-male kitchen, and I could definitely get the vibe that, you know, being an American woman chef in the kitchen was unwelcomed, and the environment was quite unwelcoming and hostile. And I think, you know, some advice that I can give any women or, you know, some color or someone, you know, whatever your sexual orientation is, if you have ADD or autism, whatever your thing is that seems to be a challenge for you to overcome in the kitchen, is hard work, man. I mean, that's what it comes down to. In a kitchen, it's definitely a survival of the fittest. And all you have to do is you got to work longer, harder, and faster to really prove yourself and establish where you should be at in the ranking, as opposed to people telling you, instead of others telling you where you should be at in the ranking, you establish that for yourself. So there's a lot of empowerment that and opportunity that can come out of these experiences.
Yeah, that's amazing. I will tell you, because I travel quite a bit, and I was raised in kitchens in Chicago, and then in New York. I've been in the South, and there is this kind of almost insular quality to, I'd say, you know, California, especially the Bay Area, all the way up into the Northwest through Oregon, through Washington State, where there does seem to be a little more focus on equality. But I've seen some pretty hostile environments, you know, for women. And, you know, the interesting thing to me that I found is, the most friendly environments for women in the kitchen, and they're pretty remarkable places, are restaurants that are actually owned by women. I say this because I had Heartbeat Restaurant here in Manhattan back in the mid to late 90s. And, I had sous chefs, and I was trying to add women to the kitchen to get that perspective, especially, just the calmness that they often bring in pretty volatile environments. And it just, you know, the personality conflict was still there in the late 90s. I do think it's improved. Dorothy, welcome. Dorothy Hamilton is on with us. And, you know, I think you probably come to this with a pretty global perspective, because I'd like to know what you're seeing from within the academic environment in culinary schools. Seems to me like more and more women are actually coming to the space and deciding to make this their career. Are you seeing this to be true? And if so, you know, what do you think they might be facing after they get themselves a high-quality education at a place like the International Culinary Center?
Thanks, Michelle, and thanks for inviting me to be on. And what a great conversation. Well, first of all, you know, I founded the school 30 years ago. And 30 years ago, it was impossible to get women in some kitchens. And I thank some of our deans, in particular Ellen Sayak, who actually opened some kitchens. And I have to tell you a funny story that, part of our final for our culinary students is we invite chefs from the city to come in and be the judges. And we had a very quite famous French chef who was working at a very top restaurant in Midtown come down, and he was testing the final, where the students have to do a dish. It's presented blind to the judges, and they just judge it. And so this chef was quite impressed with the caliber of the student final, and he turned to Ellen and says, "Ellen, you're my friend. I want the best students from this class to work. I need someone in my kitchen." And Ellen turned around and he said, "So-and-so, no." And he says, "What do you mean, no? We are friends. I came down, I did this." He goes, "No." He says, "Why?" And Ellen said, "Because you are stupid." He got outraged. And he goes, "What do you mean I'm stupid?" And he says, "Because you don't take women, and the top person in this class is a woman." And that chef took that woman and broke that kitchen. And I have to say, as the, you know, woman head of this school, we have always seen 50% women in our culinary classes, and pastry classes traditionally are 80-90% women.
So it hasn't changed then over the years.
It hasn't changed in this particular school. Traditionally, back 30 years ago, I was told it was more 75-80% men in other cooking schools and 20% women. So I don't know why. I don't think it was so transparent that I was the head. There was a woman head to this school. I don't. Maybe it was because it was New York City or something like that. But we've always had a fair amount. And today, our head chef here, our VP of Culinary Arts, is Candy Argandiza, and she is the head. We have
She's
a female
fabulous.
Head of the program.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
And I have to say, it is so much better than 30 years ago. Rome was not built in a day, but I see so much more access. And I also think that's enlightened management in the back of a kitchen, that chefs no longer can conduct themselves the way they did 30 years ago. There's a lot more respect for the worker. There's a lot more professionalism of people going into the kitchen, thanks in part to the cooking schools that instill a certain discipline and a respect of saying you don't go in a kitchen and, you know, you have to go in with these skill sets. And there's two important words, yes, chef. And so I think today there still is a difference, but it's come light years from 30 years ago.
Yeah, that's awesome. Now, Karen, from a farmer's perspective and a gardener's perspective, but you also have this public health background, right? You
yes.
know, in your journey, and I'm going to ask each of you the same question. I'd like to start with Karen. It's like, where was it when you actually, through the work that you're doing now, hit that kind of like point where you really felt like, I've succeeded, I've found what I want to do, this is what I'm really going to focus on. Share some of those success points and what it meant to you, if you would.
So I'll start. I've been doing urban agriculture in New York City for over 25 years. I always tell people, look at the grays in my hair. So there's two points I want to talk about. First was back in 2008. I went to the Santa Cruz program. CASFIS is a very unique program. 6 months living in a tent, really got close to the land. And a light bulb sort of lit up in my head when I was out in the fields, first of all, putting my hands in the soil, and all of a sudden had this connection of, you know, my ancestors and the history of slavery, you know, went through my head. And the trips that we would journey out to, I would see the farmers, and I didn't see farmers that looked like me. And so, you know, I went back and I was doing a workshop, and I asked the question, like, where are the black farmers? And then went to the ag census and looked at the numbers and was devastating. Looked at the New York State census and saw that over 55,000 white farmers, only 100 were black. And then I looked at the census, the ag census across the country, and many states don't have any black farmers. And I said, you know what? I'm going to go back and I'm going to open Pandora's box. Not because I want to bring the point home of racism, which still exists in agriculture, but the fact that if we're talking about a sustainable food system, if we're talking about a food system that is diverse and is supposedly equal for all, then the doors have to be equal for all. Mm. And then for my point is that I had to talk about the plight of the black farmer so that doors could be open. And so got together with some friends and had the first Black Farmers and Urban Farmer Conference back in 2010. And what it did was really open Pandora's box to the point that many people thought that, you know, young people of color and women did not want to go into farming. And that conference opened up doors to say, here's the masses of young people that want to be farmers, that want to be into the agricultural movement. So for me, that was a turning point. I see a lot of doors open now. I think people are starting to have a conversation. People are now looking around within their settings and saying, you know what? This movement has to be diverse. If it's monoculture that and monocropping that we're fighting against, then it has to be diverse. So that's one thing I like to say.
Well, yeah, we can't be monoculture in who is sticking their hands in the dirt.
Right.
And then on the other hand, complain about monocropping with agricultural varieties, right?
Correct. Yeah. So that's for me, that was significant change. And so now people are now starting to look at the numbers and encouraging women and people of color in the movement. That's number one. Number two, and I was telling you, Michelle, about the urban agriculture movement in New York City now. For so many years, the city was saying they don't have land, they don't have land. Well, you know what? They do have land. And the city just put out an RFP for 21 parcels of land here in the city created for urban agriculture. Pinch me, hallelujah, hallelujah. I never thought in my 25 years I would see the city now recognizing the importance of urban agriculture and now looking at it as a business tool. So those are the two things I
and
tip my hat
on. These are commercial plots, and they're not small. In Queens alone, you're talking about, what, 30 acres, right?
Exactly. So,
it's amazing.
Yeah, so those are the two things I'm proud of.
So Maria, when did it come for you? I'm going to hope that you're not going to say Top Chef. I mean, Top Chef is awesome. Don't get me wrong. Love Tom, you know, what was your moment?
Yeah. No, I would say in really starting to connect with farmers and going to the farmers markets in Seattle and developing that connection. And it's really through the farmer that I really began to learn about where my food came from and the importance of the soil and the importance of, you know, workers' rights with the farming community and really the flavor, the access to the best tasting food that you can possibly get your hands on is coming from local sustainable agriculture. So for me, that was a big turning point. And when I decided to open up my own restaurant, that had to be a big part of the mission statement.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and that's what, you know, caused me to open up a certified organic restaurant, to be 95% certified organic, because it's something that I really believe in, and it's something that, you know, I would love others to taste this food if they don't know much about organics or don't think it has that much of an impact. The hope is they're going to taste this food and become believers and slowly create some change.
Well, yeah, what's interesting, I don't want to digress too much, but, you know, since you're talking about the certified organic food thing, you know, I was really surprised. We were in D.C. together a while back, and we were at Restaurant Nora with the one and only Nora Puyan, and you guys were talking about your food costs, and I think hers is like 27% and yours is 28 or vice versa.
Yep. Yep.
I mean,
yep, it's 28. Yep. And it's 27 at Golden Beetle.
And just so that all the listeners know and our other guests, that's a really awesome food cost. I mean, restaurants generally run around 29 or 30%. Buying for price, buying to try to put the cheapest thing on the menu. And there are some restaurants that run in the low 20s, et cetera. Imagine what you're getting on your plate. But I have to commend you for that. I think it's terrific. Now, Dorothy, you're obviously coming from it a different kind of really advocacy in a way, because, you know, 30 years ago when you started the school, if somebody told their parents that they wanted to become a chef, the parent would basically go and fall on the samurai sword. Or if a neighbor
"So
what, you know, what's your child going to do for a living?" And they say they're going to be for a chef, and they say, "Oh, my condolences, I'm so sorry." That's when you
get
really
into college.
Yeah. So, you know, one would say that what you've done is a form of advocacy, because there's no question that your particular school has played a great role in changing the field. What was your moment? What was the moment that you actually decided that it was worth wading in at that inhospitable time to this idea? What made you do that?
Well, you know, I think the moment was the first moment. It was so exciting. And to call it the French Culinary Institute, you know, the biggest driver was I thought I'll get to Paris every year and be able to write it off as an expense.
Nice.
So, you know, that was like the biggest moment I think I
succulente
had. And it was maybe 2 years later of really working with chefs that I realized I had no notion what really great food and being a professional about food was about. And the momentum I had for opening the school was, you know, I'm of the age where in the 70s we all went to Europe and backpacked and we ate this great food and came back to the States and said, why don't we find these little bistros on our corners? And I felt our fish was better, our meat was better. You know, I grew up with a garden and definitely the vegetables were delicious. Why can't we cook like that? And I'm an educator. That's what I do. And I thought, it's just education. And I went to Paris and I ate at this cooking school and it was better than any of the restaurants I ate in Paris. And so we did a deal with them and brought their course over, and voila, we had the French Culinary Institute. And it was dynamic from the very start. The very first class, you'll never guess who was in that very first class. Voted least likely to succeed.
Oh, goodness.
Bobby Flay.
Oh, my God. I was going to say something.
He was 19 years old,
really?
And his father was a restaurant overseer for Joe Allen Restaurants, and
he put him
in the class. And you know what? He just blossomed. And, in fact, the scene was beginning to turn then. People were, all the young American chefs like Larry Forgione and Jonathan Waxman. Well, Jonathan was actually still on the West Coast. But, Alfred Portale was around, and David Boulay was around, and they would go to France every year. And so we were saying, we can do this food here. It was an incredibly exciting time to be in New York City, to hang out with these young chefs. I remember I used to go by Raquel's and see Thomas Keller at 11 o'clock at night, cleaning his ovens on his knees. The rest of the, it was probably more like 12 or 1 o'clock, the rest of the staff gone, and I'd have a glass of wine, sit in the back and talk with him, watching him clean his ovens, and I'd say, why don't you have your staff here? Why don't you have your cooks here cleaning? And he said, it's too important a job to leave it to my cooks. That's Thomas. Anyway, that was, right from the very start, it was exciting. And it wasn't really too much ahead of the curve. I think we hit it right on.
And now that's interesting, because now you've mentioned quite a few chefs that are friends of mine and restaurants I'm familiar with. And, back at that time, 30 years ago, those are kind of the times that I remember where in Massachusetts and New York, even in California, it was a little tough to find women in kitchens, So I was surprised to hear that it's always been kind of 50-50 and held that. I'm just, it definitely is a surprise to me. I'm happy to know that that's definitely changed.
No, so, well, so remember, back in 84, we had 50% women in the kitchen, in the school.
Right.
It was hard for us to get them in the kitchen.
Oh, yeah, so the placement was the trouble. I see.
Great deans like Jacques Pepin and Alain Seyac, they were able to twist arms and say, you are stupid, And it wasn't just the French guys that they couldn't get in.
Yeah.
I tell you, there are big-name American chef guys who ran their kitchens like football locker rooms. And they would never get away today with what they were doing back then to the women. And, we just had to, beat them up a little bit and call them out. And the school backed up some of the women in the kitchens.
That's fabulous. That's amazing. And I also just want to hold up, I love when you said young chefs, Larry Forgione, Albert Portale. It's like, I hope at least one of those guys is listening and feeling young again. I also know how old they are, about as old as I am.
And we'll tell your listeners that's Mark Forgione's father.
Oh, there you go. That's amazing. And they'll immediately relate. Well, listen, before we go to take a break, I do want to just hold up that we got news yesterday. We usually don't do news updates, but I don't know if you guys on the phone know, but Organic Valley, their headquarters in Lafarge, Wisconsin, caught fire yesterday. Nobody was hurt at all of their 400 employees, but the building's destroyed. Two-thirds of it thoroughly, thoroughly burned. So I just wanted to kind of hold them up and just say, anybody that's out there that's listening, a lot of folks on Heritage Radio Network are huge fans of companies like Stonyfield and Organic Valley, which supplies Stonyfield with a lot of their milk. But it's the largest chef-owned organic dairy co-op in the country. And to George, to Teresa, to Jerome, the leaders there, they've been friends for years, and they do have this beautiful internal, loving, nurturing culture. They care deeply about the land. They care as deeply about their employees as they do about their mission. So we just want to take this opportunity to just let everybody know that these guys are experiencing a little bit of a tough time. So, send them some good vibes. They've got a lot of offers to help and all that good stuff. But I just want to make sure everybody knows about it. And I think they're going to come out of this with flying colors. So I wanted to get that out there really, really quickly. So I hope you guys don't mind if I did that. You don't mind, right?
I don't.
No, that's great.
As a matter of fact, I just want to say, Michelle, that a couple of weeks ago, Organic Valley helped sponsor Women Share. It was 140 women from across the country, women, mothers, grandmothers, activists, foodies, farmers, together in La Crosse, Wisconsin. And the whole thing was about how women are going to change the food movement.
So, oh, boy, how apropos.
So, again, our hearts go out to Organic Valley, and any way we can help, we're there for them.
Awesome. All right, well, listen, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back and explore the delicious role women have played in moving our food system forward. You're listening to It's More Than Food on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Michelle Nashan, and we're going to return, so don't go far. Thank you.
Wake up the children, clear the halls. This is something I've been through before. Not again. If our lives depend on it, so political, analytical, intellectual, ineffectual.
You're listening to Southern Pretender by Four Lincolns on the Heritage Radio Network.org.
Sleep on it from a man in the white shoe.
Well, good afternoon, and we are back. For those of you who may have just joined us, it's More Than Food, and I'm your host, Michelle Nashan. Today's show is brought to you by Wholesome Wave, a national nonprofit that believes citizens of poverty and American farmers can unite to become heroes of a changed food system. Everybody, welcome back. We have Karen Washington, Maria Hines, Dorothy Cann Hamilton, all of whom are notable women in food. And please go to Heritage Radio Network.org to read their bios. They're freaking amazing. Now, I have to bring up something. I want to set a stage. I was at the South Carolina Coastal Conservation League meeting in Charleston about a week or two ago. And it was interesting because one of the things that they did at the conference, they're very, very concerned about what's happening with agriculture and the food systems around the very ecologically sensitive low country region. They have for years been one of the most effective conservation organizations in the country. So they had this conference, and David Orr from Oberlin College, who's brilliant, got up and spoke, and he used a paragraph, one of my favorite paragraphs from Dr. Martin Luther King. And the paragraph begins with the words, "There is such thing as too late." And it ends with, "Across history are scattered the bleached bones of civilizations upon whose tombstone could be written the words, too late." So what was interesting about this particular conference, I was there to describe Wholesome Wave programming and our partners, and we work in underserved communities of poverty of variety of ethnicities. And the one thing that I noticed, they started this off saying that ecological equity and justice and healthy ecologies can't help them if we don't have healthy societies, and we need to address the symptoms of poverty. We need to address the symptoms of lack of affordable access to food. And when you looked around the room, everybody that was in there was wealthy and white. So I took the opportunity of the opening that opening paragraph, and I opened up the race can of worms, and I said, you know, it's not. Nobody has to stretch their necks in the room to know that this is a room filled largely with people of white affluence. How do we go about representing those people of the communities that we're talking about that need to be whole if we're going to have a whole ecology if they're not here in the room? So we actually got into a conversation of instead of, you know, throwing someone the bones of a scholarship, you know, or putting a black person on your board that's highly educated, instead of maybe a black person from a community that's living in poverty, and then go, you know, do that instead of going out and studying the community that you're not reaching out to. And it was interesting because at the end of it, I thought I felt really good that I felt that I made this really good, effective point. And a gentleman came up to me and said, there's a huge white elephant that you didn't bring into your talk, and I'm a little disappointed. And it's that women are probably the most important factor in everything that you're talking about. And we need more women on our boards. We need more women in leadership roles in academia. He saw it as a big problem. And I was a little floored by that he would put that. So Karen, you are a black woman, you got like the double whammy going on here.
I got the double whammy.
Let's start with you on this, and then let's move it on through.
Yeah, so I do have the double whammy. I am African descent, and I'm a woman. And so I try to tell people in this movement, you know, we know what to do. If you want to join us, I mean, I'm talking about people who have affluence and have wealth, is that to share the resources. I think for too long, people have labeled our community as food deserts. And I hate that word food desert, because for me, it's an outsider term that someone has placed, because in our community, we have tons of food. We just don't have the right food. And so call it what it is hunger and poverty. And in a country that has so much, why is it poverty and hunger and poverty? And it's shameful. And it continues to be shameful until people understand that food is a right and not a privilege for some. That's number one. Number two, I went to Women's Share 2 weeks ago, around 140 women. And I myself, after doing all this work, I said to myself, what can I do? What can I do in my community? And even though I do a lot, I run a farmer's market, I grow food, still, how do I meet people where they are? And I said, you know what I'm going to do with some of my friends? I'm going to set a table setting. Have my community come to a table. I'm going to ask all my farming friends and my foodie friends, take maybe 10 families and have a nice dinner setting for them. And we, the people, the farming, we're going to cook for these families. We're going to cook for these families, the food that we grow, and we're going to sit down and we're going to talk about the food and why it's difficult for people who are poor to have food like this, and sit down and have them feel appreciative. And I think for me, in the food movement, I think we need to go to the people and we need to sit down and break bread and ask them, what is wrong with the food system? Why is it difficult for you to have access? Because I think for too long, like you said, Michelle, people will throw in dollars and grants and donations to make them feel good.
Yeah.
But that doesn't solve the problem. We need to sit down and break bread with people and find out exactly what is the problem. What can we do? This is the food that we grow. Eat it, taste it. What is it that we can do so that you can go to a store and challenge the grocery store, challenge the bodega to make sure that there's food that's there that's healthy? That's what I'm going to do this year. I'm going to make sure that I meet my people where they are and start bringing them into the food movement by sitting them down, cooking healthy food for them, making them eat it, and then listening to why there's a problem around the food that they're eating.
Yeah, that's awesome. Wow. Everybody clap. I'm clapping.
I'm inviting you all on this call to come out and join me.
Awesome. Anyway, so Maria, we've been doing these things with the James Beard Foundation, these chefs boot camps for policy and change, and we bring around, you know, a dozen or so chefs who are interested in advocacy, and then we talk about issues. And it's actually these issues of poverty and lack of affordable access that often kind of come front and center a lot of the conversations that we have over the 2 days that we do these things. You went back after the first one, Maria, all fired up and stuff like that, and then the Wholesome Wave phones almost started kind of ringing off the hook with your energy, and you started gathering some community members. Tell me about your journey and how that's going, because there a lot of people think of Seattle and it's like, oh, this great food town where everything's absolutely wonderful and there's a Pike Place Market and visions of people throwing giant, beautiful, fat salmon around. But there's some real poverty in Seattle, around Seattle, both urban and rural in your area. Give us a feeling of the deal out there and what you think your role is in making that different.
Yeah, there absolutely is a big problem with poverty, a big problem with getting access and affordability to low-income families when it comes to fresh, healthy food. And it's a real challenge. And I've spent, you know, the good part of my career being a champion for organics and healthy eating, and it's always come up that, well, it's great if you can afford it. And I think my journey for the past year and a half is, well, how do I help and how do I assist in creating more food equality? Because there's just such a big gap. And it's been helpful with the James Beard Foundation. They put together a really great program for chefs who want to learn about policy and advocacy. And Michelle Nishan actually does a good portion of leading the chefs in that boot camp.
Don't be talking about me now. Don't do that. Stop that.
Yeah, well, I won't. But honestly, it is Wholesome Wave that's been super helpful and supportive of the program that we've put in place last year in regards to SNAP incentives for recipients who go to the farmers markets to actually get access to fresh fruits and vegetables. So that's currently where the city's at right now as far as trying to make a change. And right now we're in the middle of expanding that pilot this year again in order to do the same thing.
That's awesome.
And hence the ringing of the phone at Wholesome Waves. It's been great in information sharing to move this forward.
Phones were invented so that you could hear the bell ring. That's the whole deal, man. So it's awesome. Now, you know, I think in just closing the loop on that convo, I thought was pretty interesting about the Seattle area was about how a lot of these markets, unfederated, you know, some individual markets, Karen, so kind of like what you guys do with Just Food, and then there's you know, Green City Markets. There's all these different, farmers markets organizations, they just all independently on their own without kind of talking about it, started going out and doing these incentive programs so that people living on food stamp benefits could get double bucks to afford the local stuff. It just kind of like started blossoming. So Maria's kind of like, let me hold a lasso here and let's bring everybody together and collaborate in a way that we're working as a whole community around this. It's pretty cool. So Dorothy,
collaboration. Yeah. It's not run by one organization. The Fresh Bucks program isn't run by Fresh Bucks. It's ran by, you know, it's driven by chefs, nonprofits, foundations, the city,
some food policy person, right, or something?
Yeah, food policy advisor. So to get as far as it's come without having, you know, one place that everyone operates out of is very helpful.
That's awesome. Well, that shows you what the power of community. And, you know, speaking of that, Dorothy, so it speaks to the change from French Culinary Institute to the International Culinary Academy. You guys are doing now, you have an Italian kind of culinary center. You have a Spanish one, Jose Andres is doing.
I know.
But it's really awesome to see how the school has grown and how far ahead you guys are on making sure that these cultures are represented. I want to go back to I think it was around 2002, you made a pretty bold move. I think you appointed Alice Waters as your dean of sustainability.
Yes.
And did some really earnest work in trying to change the sourcing and everything like that to have more local, more organics, more sustainable. So when we talk about affordability, because, you know, I have this theory that if Walmart is going 15% of all of its fresh product is going to come from within 150 miles of its regional redistribution warehouse. I do go to Walmarts from time to time to see what's going on. I don't remember seeing a yuppie aisle in Walmart, you know.
Right.
So I'm thinking that if it's important to them, it's important to all their shoppers. But there's still this, and they have this, the hugest retail organic section, there's still this perception that it's expensive. How has it worked out for you guys operationally from a wholesale cost perspective to make these bold moves into sourcing more sustainable product, which often are purchased from farmers who are paying their workers well, often working the fields themselves? What has it been a struggle for you guys? How's it going? Tell me.
In short, yes, because it's expensive, you know,
yeah.
And we want to be realistic with our students and to say, you know, go out, start your restaurant, be 100% organic, sustainable. It's impossible, you know, for a young, struggling business because of the cost of it. Now, that being said, that doesn't mean you have to abandon it all.
Right.
And I think that it is a lot more affordable today because, you know, 30 years ago, the only word with organic was chemistry. No one knew the word. And, in fact, I remember having a conversation in those early years with Hillary Baum and Alice Waters. We were sitting in the back of a taxi. And I said, sustainable, what does that mean? That was even a bizarre word for people to get their arms around. And I think basically what we want from young chefs today and young restaurant owners is responsibility, mm-hmm. you know, of being aware, trying to source locally because it's better. It's better food, it's tastier food, and it's responsible. And it supports, you know, the mid-sized farm movement. I don't know if you know what's grown out of that, Michelle, is we've started a farm-to-table intensive here. And it's incredibly exciting. And both farm-to-table courses are our basic culinary course, but with farm-to-table components in it. And we have a school out in Silicon Valley at the top of the Salinas Valley. And the course in New York and the course in California are different because the food systems are different in the two states.
Yeah,
in New York, we teach, we take them to urban gardens, rooftop gardens, four-season gardens, and they spend the last week up at Stone Barns with Dan, who's our graduate, Dan Barber, and they spend a whole day on soil. They learn how to break down an animal. They learn that chickens and eggs are seasonal. You know, so many chefs don't know that. So they're really getting closer to the land, more responsible, and understanding that they have to understand where their food's coming from and how it's sourced. On the other side, on the other coast in California, we realize that, you know what, chefs have to buy industrial carrots. It's a function of cost. And so Karen Karp helped put us together the more industrial program out there, and they go to Bolthouse Farms, which, you know, is a responsible industrial farm, and they're going to sit on the back of a combine and see 10,000 pounds of carrots being harvested. But at the same time, they're going to go to a mid-sized farm to see how, as a chef, they can work with a farmer. And our dean out there is David Kinch. His Love Apple Farm, they go, and they see what it is to have a $2 carrot as opposed to a 2-cent carrot.
Right.
And what's the difference? And why would you buy a $2 carrot or a mid-sized carrot? And that's the kind of education our chefs need to know today. We take them to the Monterey Aquarium because there are a lot more fish in the sea than the 12 that we have names for, and they have to be a partner in the sustainable cause with our oceans. And, you know, that's why we became the center. You know, people heard French to international, but we changed institute to center because you can't train a chef in the four walls of a kitchen anymore. Mm. We take our students outside of the kitchen. The kitchen skills are absolutely necessary, but so are sustainable sourcing skills.
Well, that's amazing. So really the concept has been to take the classroom to the field and then in turn bring the field back into the classroom. It's like closing the holistic circle. That's awesome. My God, you know, I see myself as like one of the luckiest people in the world because I get to have such amazing friends and make, you know, such amazing connections, and it's just rich because, you know, a lot of people you know, could any one of the things that the three of you are doing, you really could do for the simple activity of what it is. You know, farming is farming. I plant the seeds, I harvest the plant, I do care about the dirt and stuff like that, but at the end of the day, you know, I'm tired, I want to go to bed, I'm going to wake up tomorrow, do the same thing. If I can make enough money and grow enough food to be okay, I'm good. But you know, Karen, you take it farther than that. Maria, same thing. It's like, yeah, I'm gonna go to school. I'm gonna work in the kitchen. I'm gonna open my own business, and I'm gonna have the best restaurant. I'm gonna outcompete everybody else. I'll differentiate myself by being organic. But you know, I'll just be happy if the restaurant's successful. But it's more than that. You're reaching out into your community. And Dorothy, the way you've grown the center from the Institute, it's just astonishing. And what it's given so many people is something. So you guys are all heroines of mine. So I want to kind of close off the last part of the show by giving you each an opportunity to think about and hold up and celebrate a food heroine who's been important to you. And by the way, if you hear any banging in the background, here at Roberta's Restaurant in Brooklyn, right above the studio, there are containers, and in the containers, they build raised bed gardens to grow their own food. So we hear some hammering going on right now. So don't worry, it's all about food. So anyway, you're some of your favorite food heroines. Let's start with you, Karen.
Yeah, so I was thinking about this question, and I just got to say that, you know, I can't single out one person. I want to thank my ancestors. I want to thank the people, the women that laid down this trail, blood, sweat, and tears so that I can do the work that I'm doing, so many of us can do the work that we're doing. There are so many people out there who have been nameless, who've never asked for credit, who've never asked for the awards, have done the work, have sacrificed so much. For me to be sitting here and talking to you all, I mean, I want to give a big, big up to those trailblazers before me who have allowed me to sit here today, to allow me to grow food, to allow me to be a voice. And I just want to thank my ancestors, my sisters, that who remain nameless, for allowing me to be here.
Wow. Oh, wow. Awesome. You're taking me down. Okay, Maria, hard act to follow. Your turn.
Yeah. I would say, you know, a young cook growing up in the, you know, the chef world, definitely Alice Waters and Noor Pouillon and Ann Cooper are my ultimate heroes, from all the work that they've done and setting the example for me that it's important to invest in more than just money as you go through this path of food, how it's important to invest in your community, it's important to invest in the environment, and it's important to invest in people's health as well as, you know, being a profitable operation.
That's fabulous. They're all terrific. And I'm going to guess that as you go through your daily duties at everything that you're doing at Golden Beetle and Tilth and Agrodolce, that they come to mind pretty often, I would guess, just as it's evident that they do so for Karen. You think about them often?
Absolutely. They're a phone call away at times, actually.
That's awesome. Dorothy, your turn.
Well, it's easy for me. 30 years ago, the first week we were open, Julia Child walked in the door. Mm. She was so tall, she took most of the door space. She came through, and she was the biggest supporter of women in the food industry. She knew how hard it was. And the minute she heard that I had opened the French Culinary Institute, okay, I got the point on being French with her. But then when she found out it was a woman, she just became my fairy godmother. She put us on Good Morning America. She introduced me to Jim Beard. She made me join the AIWF and the IACP. And she made sure I met everyone there. And she's really a role model, because that's what I try to do for young women today. And then the other women that really inspire me, I have to say, are the women faculty that we've had at the school. They are the consummate professionals. As I said, our head chef for our whole big prestigious school here is a woman, Candy Organdiza, and she got outstanding faculty member for the United States from the IACP. What professionalism, even in the face of some, gender challenges that have been in the last 30 years. Emily Lucchetti is a dean here, and, you know, she is now the chairman of the James Beard Foundation. These are women, despite whatever added hurdles that they had to go through, have come out without bitching and moaning and or complaining. They just did it. And today, they and the young women I see coming through the school here are inspirational to me.
That's fabulous. So now, this is our opportunity for parting shot, and then we go away. You guys get an opportunity to tell us what we can look forward to you in the coming next couple of years. I think the table is set for pretty delicious change as a result of who you are and what you're doing. Karen, what's up? What's on the horizon?
Well, I've been a physical therapist. That's one of my hats for 36 years. I'm going to retire next year and hopefully be farming with seven of my favorite friends, getting some land upstate. We're going to farm it. We have a name for the farm already. I don't want to give it away.
Oh, come on.
Kale, yeah.
Yeah.
And hopefully, you know, really give back the blessings that so many people have given me. And, yeah, look out for Kale, yeah, in the future.
That's awesome. Awesome. Cool. Now, Maria.
Well, I've started working with a farmer on trying to develop a for-profit sustainable business model that brings food justice to the system and allows, you know, underserved communities to be able to purchase local sustainable food at a price in which a business can actually, you know, profit from.
Now, interesting. So when you say, you know, bringing food justice into the business model, are you talking about the, you know, all of the aspects of the operation, human resources, all that jazz? Take us a little deeper into
absolutely.
That. Absolutely. That sounds interesting.
Absolutely. And, you know, and the food equality. I mean, just really trying to level that playing field in a way that is also still a for-profit sustainable business model. If it's something that, you know, I can do to help assist in, you know, in setting an example, it would be fantastic. If every inner city area, if every, you know, rural area of low income could have some sort of model in which you could get food that's going to be local and sustainable and healthy for your family, that would be a big win.
That's awesome. Awesome, awesome, awesome. And it'll be delicious as well, wouldn't it?
You better believe it. Awesome.
Dorothy, you get to kind of close us out with your last word, but I'm still having trouble shaking the vision of Julia Child as a fairy godmother. How can somebody who talks like this be a fairy godmother?
She was a love. She really was. But anyway, you know what, the one thing about this, having a school, is, you know, riding the wholesome wave, if I can steal
Yay!
Your word, that what we try to do is just not follow the industry, but be shoulder to shoulder and lead it, you know, and it's our job to know where the industry is going to be in 5 years and prepare people for it. So we're working on some great things. We're expanding even more internationally into Asia,
wow.
But more so we're looking back at ourselves, constantly tweaking our curriculums, upgrading them, incorporating what we think are the, like our new farm-to-table course, customizing our curriculums for our students. I don't know what tomorrow will bring because we're going to be there and we're ready to take the next challenge. But it will definitely be with responsibility, not only to our future chefs, but to our future eaters. And, the other big area we're involved with is school food. Mm. And I think institutional cooking really needs our attention, and we're going to definitely be in that space.
And the space is going to be better for it. It's such an important place. And, you know, I just think, for all of the work that all of y'all are doing, there's my Morley, Missouri coming out of me, for all of the work that you're doing, I just can't help but feel that 5, 10, and 15 years from now, the world is going to be a much more fairly and rightly delicious place to live. So I want to thank all three of you for joining me today. I mean, I love you all. Your work is fabulous. It's super, super amazing. Those of you that are out there, if you haven't gone to heritageradionetwork.org and checked out these bios, check them out and support all three of these magnificent women who are notable women in food. Just a closing parting shot from me. Quick news, the Farm Bill, a version of the Farm Bill passed the House Ag Committee today. We're a little bummed because they're cutting the SNAP program by $20 billion over 10 years. A little relieved because they were going for $36 billion in cuts. We are happy that the incentives that double food stamps when spent at farmers markets on locally grown food made it through that bill and passed 30-10. But we want you all to know that your target is the Senate. The Senate has a much kinder version of this bill. We want the House bill to pass. We want the Senate bill to pass so that it can go to conference, so that the conservation issues, the community food project issues can be negotiated up to a much more reasonable level so that people living in poverty can work with farmers to become heroes of a changed food system. That's what we're fighting for. Thanks for listening to It's More Than Food. I'm Michel Nashan. I'd like to thank Heritage Radio Network for their support, for hosting today's show. We're sponsored by Wholesome Wave. And listen, go love somebody for through food today. Cook a good meal, pick a good meal, whatever you do, enjoy a good meal, and look in the eyes of the people that you love, your family, your friends, and just realize that if you can feed each other, the world's a better place.
I've got to be the one who makes me a better man.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
A sustainable life. I need to move steady.